I guess, yeah, I guess we're, Angie's going to go first, and then Waddell, and then me.
My name's Angie Morrill, and I am from Portland, Oregon. I'm MoDOT Klamath, and I was never, lived on a reservation. I don't know how to speak Klamath or MoDOT. I'm just going to go ahead and, well, forget it. I guess this is just pointless. Oh, it's working? Oh, awesome. Okay. So, Miguel just said that you wouldn't come here necessarily if you were native, and that's true. Well, all my mentors at the University of Oregon, where I got my undergrad degree in ethnic studies, told me to go to Berkeley or USC, the other schools that I was accepted to, and those were good ideas and choices, but I came here because of the community in the ethnic studies department, because it is small, and that's one thing that worked for me at University of Oregon was having intense mentorship and a lot of attention, and so I thought that I could get that here. But the lack of community here, my cousin was the president of the Native American Student Union. Me and some friends started a women's group of the Native American students when one of the directors of the Native American Students Union raped one of the members. And we had a lot of meetings, and we had Andrea Smith come and talk to our community, and the man left school. He was a grad student there. And his community ended up knowing about what happened. There were yearly powwows. We have a beautiful longhouse at the University of Oregon. And my mentor, Brian Kopotic, is Mississippi Choctaw. My another mentor of mine, Sherry Hendorf, there is Alaskan Native. So I had this community there that supported me intellectually and culturally, and then I came here, and it was gone. It was completely gone, and I had no idea that it would be so hard. I'm also a single parent, and so leaving my family behind was devastating, because even though my parents live a few hours away, they only live a few hours away, and so we always keep in contact there. We visit them often, and so I think that one thing that changed and my life and made it so that I could succeed here was last spring, Madel really casually, in passing, asked if I would be interested in doing a directed reading with her and Maget. And so a community was formed. So I said, yes, and on what? And it was Indigenous epistemologies. What's that? Is that like what Robert Warrior talks about in Tribal Secrets? I guess, I think so. So we got together with Ross Frank, who's going to be teaching now this class to graduate students in the fall. So you can see, like, from an idea Madel had, it's now in curriculum, which is pretty amazing. It's also, indigeneity has been added to our mission statement in our department, to the vision statement, and it's become something that we talk about. And I'm not saying that we're the only ones who ever talked about it, but we certainly helped get more attention in the department for this area. Certainly, like, other professors were focused on indigeneity, like Professor Alvarez and Ross Frank, but it's becoming a really important, like, intellectual site, Indigenous studies, and because of Madel and Maget and I's conversations about it, it's kind of cool that our department has this sort of focus, I think, sort of because we're focused on it. One reason we're focused on it is because it's not that easy to do Indigenous studies within ethnic studies. They're not the same. And so there are conflicts, there are problems. that I'm sure Megat and Madel will focus on addressing. I'm going to talk a little bit more about myself and how I came to be like a 41-year-old single mom grad student from Oregon at UCSD. Because certainly when you look around at like who's in academia, you don't see a lot of people like me. Like the fact that there's no other native grad students. I think there is one in the music department. That's what people tell me. He plays the flute. I'm sure someday we'll meet. I just got an email. I just got an email saying there's some undergrad students who are going to try and start a Native American Student Union on Tuesday at 3 p.m. Two of them are meeting at the... are you? All right, well... at 3 p.m. and I was thinking about heading down there, and because that is, it's really important. It can be really cool to have a place to go. I know as an undergrad, having at University of Oregon, there's this hallway, and we just call it the hallway, and you know, all the groups have a room. You know, they have a couch, they have a desk, they have an old Apple, and you can just wander in there and just hang out, and it's always really nice to see, you know, just to see people sometimes, because you often feel like you're the only one, or you have experiences like I did one time in a class, it was one of those ones you have to take, like geology or something, and the professor called, well, I don't know why he would do this, but he said Eskimos were a lot like Neanderthals, you know, like stuff like that, where you're just like, what am I doing here? Why am I even in this university? Like, there's so many messages you get, like, you're not supposed to be here, you don't belong here, they're not talking to you. But if you do persevere, and if you find some place where you can work, like ethnic studies, then that can be a site to examine these things that are important to you. For me, you know, I'm interested in race, I'm interested in social justice. My work specifically right now, I'm working on my master's thesis, I'm in the second year cohort, and I'm looking at my family as a site to examine indigeneity and ethnic studies and racial justice. Because there are a lot of things that happened, like within my family, that happened to Native American people in the 20th century. The Klamath tribe was terminated in 1953, and it wasn't restored until 1986. And so, growing up, like my link to indigeneity was broken. I mean, my mom was an enrolled member of a tribe that I couldn't be enrolled in, that didn't exist. You know, I mean, really, like. People, so I, you know, when my mom, we asked her, like, well, what do we say we are? And she's like, say Modoc, or if people don't know what that is, just say you're Klamath. But it was definitely a disconnect. One reason I think that we persevere in claiming like this indigeneity in the face of like this termination was because of the timing of my mom's divorce from her first husband and moving back to Portland happened right at the beginning of the 1970s. And at that time, the student group had just taken over Alcatraz Island and the American Indian Movement, which was a group from Minneapolis, I think. It's going to sound great on the podcast. not like I haven't read like a million books, but you say it's early. I know. They were a group with that had mostly urban roots, but they also had relationships with people on reservations, and they had started. Well, and there were also like the Yakima Washington Indians and the fishing rights that were going on in the 1960s. Anyway, there was just a groundswell of interest and activism. It was, of course, the times, but it really energized like urban communities like the one I lived in Portland. And so My uncle, Tom Ball, was really active, and he got my mom involved, and she started a women's group, and they opened a daycare center just for Indian kids. And so I grew up like where there was weekly like powwows, weekly cultural drumming and dancing meetings, and so it was a really exciting time, and it was really an important time for people to sort of connect with being Indian after like sort of a... When my mom grew up, they always thought she was Chinese. Growing up, people always think I'm Italian. Depending on what neighborhood I'm living in, sometimes they think I'm Mexican. Like, they know I'm something, but they're not sure what it is. Nobody will ever guess, you know, that you're native, often. Okay, I think I've taken up enough time with my talk. Yeah.
Okay, so, I go by Madel. My full proper name is Mabel Sar Nirengas, and and I've most recently started reusing my grandfather's name that I sort of left out all these years for many reasons, and I can get into that later. But I was born and mostly raised on Belau. And then came out here. So I often talk about myself to sort of give people an idea of why I do the kind of work I do. So the short version is I grew up very much embedded in the Seventh-day Adventist religion, which is the second largest religion on my island. And so I went to a mission school. And at that mission school, I learned a lot of American history. That's actually all I learned. And then I, through that mission, after graduating from high school, went on to a college in Walla Walla, Washington, that is also a Seventh-day Adventist college, where I was supposed to pursue a degree in civil engineering and become this very, you know, prominent civil engineering woman, but that didn't happen. I sort of got sidetracked, had two kids, and ended up going to Washington State University, which was much cheaper, and finding my niche there. So after having my two kids, I went back to college in 2002, and I, in 2002, I went back to Washington State University, and I was majoring at the time in political science and history, and it would just frustrate me to sit through these classes and never, ever, they would talk about all the wars, you know, leading up to World War II, and never, ever mention, you know, the impact that it had on my people or my island, right? So I then started taking classes in women's studies and ethnic studies, and I ended up changing my major and then getting a dual degrees, one in history and one in women's studies. And then I was looking for grad schools around, and I ended up choosing San Diego primarily because my brother is stationed in the Navy here, and so I decided that it was best for my children and I to move here. I'm also a single parent to be closer to my family. Although I was also very fortunate at Washington State University to have a large Pacific Islander community there, but they were primarily from Polynesia, so there were a lot of Samoans, Tongans there, and then we had a small Micronesian group, and then when they all sort of drifted off, I was still around, and the Native American community there sort of adopted me and my kids, and I became very much involved in Indigenous discourse. And I never had identified, actually, as an Indigenous person up until that point. And it really started to make me think about what that meant. What does indigeneity mean? Who can claim that space, that label? And then, do I fit in that, necessarily? And when I started thinking about that, I really had to go back and think about the history of my island, which I had no knowledge of. I honestly, up till that point in 2002, had no background on my island, the political or any sort of social historical aspects, except for what I learned growing up from my family and, you know, the community. So then I actually, because there's more literature on Native American sort of indigenous epistemologies and whatnot, I became very intrigued with Native American studies and sort of focused on that, and then came to ethnic studies still with that drive to understand indigeneity. But I've always really focused my work on militarism, primarily because of how it's affected and impacted my family. My father comes from 16 brothers and sisters, all from the same woman, and she is like the same parents. She's shorter than me, and she's really petite. You would never guess she had 16 kids. But everybody except my father has been enlisted or is still enlisted in the military at this time. And so military sort of runs in our family, and now my brother and my cousins are enlisted. So I've always been curious to understand, though, how we were able to sort of serve the U.S. in that way. How is it that people from my country, which at the time when I started thinking about it, we were a territory, and then we gained our independence in 94. Now, Palauans can still serve in the military and retain our citizenship to our country. So I think that's a very interesting sort of point that I'm trying to understand right now. And then why we would want to do that as an independent nation, right? Like, why would another nation want to serve another nation and support them and then defend their whatever, right? So that's sort of the kind of work that I do right now. I know you guys read, was it, who did you read for the class?
We read one chapter by Stevens, the one, the Speaking of Power.
Okay. We just did a short article. Did you guys touch on the women's group that?
Yeah, there was a little bit of the women's group there, and I talked about it in class.
Okay, so, I mean, because this class is about social movements, I wanted to just talk about what my connection to that is, in terms of how grassroots work, you know, sort of from the bottom up. One of my teachers in high school, she was actually one of the leading women who led that movement. She was a younger woman out of all of them, but she was most articulate in speaking English. And so she was one of the women who helped translate and then brought these women to Washington, D.C. to speak before the committee. And so she was my teacher in high school, didn't know anything about this movement. She would always talk about, I can't even remember what she taught. I feel like she taught English or something. And so I've known her, right? We kind of all know, there's only 20,000 of us on this planet, so we kind of all know each other. So I've known this woman, and I've known the woman, Gabriela Niramang, who was the one who was always targeted and sort of threatened. They threatened her life. I've always known her. She's a close friend of my grandmother, but never did I know what the kinds of things these women were doing, right? But this is sort of how I think about colonialism and how it's affected my country, right? So I've always known who the U.S. president was. I didn't know who the Palauan president was growing up in elementary school. I knew about Disneyland. I knew all kinds of things about the United States. So when I came here, I was very acclimated. I was able to sort of assimilate as best as possible without, but people would often say, oh, you speak such good English. You know, like, okay, but that's our official language, you know, so why wouldn't I? So I just feel like it's really interesting these histories that we come from sort of have moved us in ways that we don't even realize towards the kind of work that we're doing. And so I'm going to leave it at that and let me get.
I want to be on the board. I haven't seen a chalkboard in a long time. Okay, so who can guess what fish, trees, birds, Angie, Madel, and me have in common? Anyone guess?
Indigenous.
No. No, we're all, our existences are all administered by the Department of the Interior of the United States. So, the federal government of the United States, which, because I'm from Guam, I don't have any power in electing or have a representative who votes. Neither does Madel. What's it called? Our existences are determined by the same agency which is in charge of administering the fish, the trees, and the birds of the United States. And so all of us, them included, exist kind of in this category of things which can't really exist on their own, so that need to be kind of taken care of. You know, so this idea of this, the federal indigenous relationship in the United States is one based on paternalism, infantilization, that if we don't take care of these people, they will die out. You know, if we don't take care of the birds, they're going to disappear. If we don't take care of the Indians, they're going to disappear. If we don't take care of the Chamorros, they're going to disappear. And so we all sit, the three of us. So, one thing that you should always, to determine kind of indigenous versus racial in terms of the nation, sovereignty is the issue. So sovereignty, and I'll write it because it's very important, is the thing which will distinguish any other ethnic group in the U.S. nation from an indigenous person in the U.S. nation. And in terms of us three, we exist in a way in which the federal government has kind of determined that we should not have sovereignty, or that we should have kind of small doses of sovereignty, and that over centuries, a little bit should be given to us, and then it should be taken back. So, in Madel's example, for example, Madel's island was given sovereignty, but then the United States negotiated its existence into the center of how Madel's island exists politically. So even though Madel's island is sovereign, like, it's still the department, it's not the State Department that interacts with Palau, it's the Department of the Interior, just like it's the Department of Interior that interacts with Guam. So this issue is very important. And so on Guam, for instance, the issue of sovereignty in terms of organizing, in terms of social movements, ultimately comes down to the issue of intramorotano or land. Because Guam is 220 square miles, situated on the edge of the Western Pacific, the largest and closest island to the Asian continent, and so it is extremely strategically important for the United States. So, what's it called? So Guam, a colony, a beautiful, strategically important colony of the United States, gets called the tip of America's spear, pointed towards Asia, an unsinkable aircraft carrier. In military discourse, Guam is incredibly important. And it's incredibly important for a number of reasons, and one of them is this lack of sovereignty, is that so, in other nations, you have a VFA, or a SOFA, an SOFA, a Visiting Forces Agreement, a Status of Forces Agreement, in order to use the land or negotiate the terms in which your base, the U.S. base is there. In Guam, because the U.S. says it owns Guam, it controls Guam, there's no need for any of these things. The United States can militarize Guam to its heart's content, can move anything it wants in and out of there. Let me just give you a picture of land on Guam and the military presence on Guam. So let's say from 1898 to 1941, there's, let's say, about 500 to 1,000 U.S. military forces on Guam that basically only exist on a couple of square miles of the island. Guam is invaded by the Japanese in 1941, occupied for 3 years, and then the U.S. returns in 1944, and the U.S. comes back and takes two-thirds of the island, taking the land from Chamorros, and then puts about 200,000 military on it. So, and then now if you go on to today, the U.S. military still controls one-third of the island. And in the next couple of years, there will be anywhere from 30,000 to 40,000 U.S. military personnel on the island. And so over the past century, kind of what has really mobilized social movements and political organizing on Guam has been this issue of land. Because prior, so during this era, there was a lot of Chamorro kind of subtle discontent against being a colony, not having any rights. Because at this time, the island is basically it's controlled by a naval governor, and it's basically, as one person referred to it, a dictatorship American style. Chamorros have no rights except that which the naval governor determines that they can have. So Chamorros are arrested without habeas corpus. There's laws against whistling. You can't whistle if the governor says you can't whistle in public. There's laws about who you can marry, who you can't marry. There's laws that say you have to collect a certain number of rats each month. So this is an insane, weird period. But after World War II, what's it called? The United States takes 2/3 of the island, and at some point, takes forcibly the land from Chamorros. At other points, Chamorros willingly give it up because they're glad that the United States has returned from the Japanese. And so this starts this kind of generations of Chamorros that are landless, that don't have, you know, that it breaks the subsistence farming lifestyle that was there. And so now Chamorros have to depend upon welfare of the United States, the cash economy, in order to survive. What this eventually starts is different movements in which Chamorros start trying to get the land back. Because a lot of Chamorros were told that, oh, you know, we'll just use this land for the war and then you'll get it back. But throughout, from 1944 to the 1990s, much of the land had never been returned and was never even used. The military had just taken it. And so land becomes the issue that will turn anyone on Guam. A nurse, a teacher, a soldier, would basically turn them into an activist or a radical. So, just to speak about one social movement in Guam, because it's really interesting to talk about organic intellectuals, the idea that they come from experiences and from communities, and because for generations in Guam, the activists were basically people who wanted to be American. So they were educated, they were wealthy, they were the colonial elites, and they said, would you please give us citizenship? And they sent dozens of petitions, which were rejected and so on, until after World War II, when they were finally accepted. But they basically have no effect on the federal government and its relationship with Guam. It wasn't until kind of the landless and the poor Chamorros who didn't have much, and, you know, who were forced to join the military to leave the island, but then when they joined the military, they were treated, especially in Vietnam, they were treated as if they were gooks and the enemies and stuff, and encountered incredible racism in the U.S. military. They would return to Guam, and they would basically organize. And eventually, instead of beating up American servicemen on the island, which was the common thing in the 60s and 70s, if you hated your lot in life, you would beat up military kids or beat up military in the bar. Then they started organizing. And eventually, this group called the Nación Chamorro, Chamorro Nation, developed. And in the 1990s, they actually were able to, through a lot of civil disobedience and protests, they were actually able to get the United States military to return a lot of land and get the government in Guam to create, or to finally enact legislation to give land to landless Chamorros.
What is that movement called again?
Or it's a group, it's called Nación. Nación Chamorro.
Also, if you go to the website, there's a link to some of Maguette's dozens of blogs. And
he talks a lot about that stuff, yeah.
Yeah. But so that's a very important thing for indigenous people and indigenous struggles, is that there be this land that they can control and that they can do with and that they have sovereignty over. And not just sovereignty in the sense that the United States says, well, we'll let you use it. You know, because that's the relationship that Native Americans have with the United States, is that the federal government holds their land, and if it wants to, it develops their land, and then it gives a portion of it to Native Americans.
So unlike Maguette, unlike Guam's situation, Palau's very different because we're independent, and yet we're still sort of functioning under the Department of Interior, right? So, and then for Chamorros, their issue is land. We still... For the most part, control our land usage and whatnot. There is a clause in the compact that says if the United States ever needs to come in and use the land, that they have a designated area, which is tarnished of yet. I mean, it's still very much sort of, what do they call it out here?
Pristine?
No, it's pristine. So it's like rainforest type of land that hasn't been developed. And so this is the area that they have designated as U.S. military land. And then if they need more land, if they ever need more land, there's also a clause that says that they can come in and purchase the land at the price in which they set. So the indigenous folks sort of have to just give it up, you know. But there is this nicety about it that they're actually paying for the land, which is unlike the situation for Chamorros, who were just sort of yanked from them. And then the other thing is the way that the U.S. On the surface deals with Palau, very diplomatic. So it appears like Palau is just another independent nation, sort of in agreement or in alignment with the U.S. So we're part of the Coalition of the Willing, if you guys are familiar with that. There are countries listed that are in support of this war, and Palau, a nation of 20,000 people, not to minimize that, but we're listed as one of the nations that support the U.S. or support this coalition, right? So my project sort of interrogates the ways in which nation is dealt with, even in the relationship we have with the United States. So we're still sort of we're very much dependent. But I think our sovereignty lies in our political, economic, sort of global framework, and less about the land issues that Chamorros have to deal with. And then I'm still learning about our history, but from what I've read, there's not a clear or sort of designated group that has been like a sovereignty movement on my island. There are instances like this women's group who worked towards keeping our nuclear free clause in our constitution and things like that, but there's not this huge sovereignty movement like Nación Chamorro that Miguel just talked about.
But that is, in some sense, that is a sovereignty movement, though,
yeah.
Because it's ultimately that your sovereignty will be proven in moments like that.
And in different spaces and at different...
Where the interests of a particular nation or community, where they conflict with the desires, the strategic military desires of another. And so your sovereignty in that sense is, does the framework that governs your interactions respect that you have interests? Or that you have interests and you have a right to have them and defend them? But then from the Palawan case, it was obvious that your interests were not respected no matter what. You were allowed decolonization and independence so long as you did not exceed what the United States was willing to give you. And
To say that more clearly, the only way in which we were granted independence in 1994 was if we changed our constitution to take out that nuclear free clause. So for many years, there was civil unrest on my island because of the different political parties who were in opposition and who were for the nuclear free clause. And finally, it was able to pass, and then the U.S. said, okay, since it's out, we can now give you your independence. So it was based on, there were strings attached, right? Like, and there are still strings attached to it.
Could you say a little something? We've been talking a lot about autonomy, you know, because if you look at a lot of the literature, especially related to indigenous movements, they talk about autonomy. And sovereignty is very related, but at the same time, it's also very, very different.
Well, I mean,
you know, okay. You're talking about nations,
right?
Where we talk about nations in the U.S., but they're really not nations. We're talking about there's still reservations and there's autonomy at a certain degree, but the sovereignty part of it, is completely contested.
Well, people are frightened. I mean, there's that. Okay, so I don't know how many people were watching the headlines, but a little over a week ago, the Cherokee, 77% of them voted to oust the Cherokee freedmen, who were the descendants of slaves
owned by the Cherokee. They were guaranteed enrollment in the tribe, in the treaty, and many of them are our descendants, you know, with Cherokee, you know, ancestors. And so, so one thing that's going to happen, because it has to, because this is an outrageous thing that was done, is that the Supreme Court's going to have to rule on this. And, you know, so people are like, well, let the Cherokee take care of their own. Well, what do you do, though, when your tribe's being run by racists? You know, I mean, and there, and when people are communities, you know, one thing that happens in Indian communities is that there tends to be this conversation between Indians and white people that goes on and that gets talked about. But that doesn't include, like, how we're racialized and within a racialized nation, you know, like, and that there's a lot of, so we're affected by these conversations, you know, and by these ideologies. And we hold often ideas and beliefs, and here the Cherokee had this power, you know, to act. And they acted to oust the freedmen. They didn't really, I mean, it was, I don't really see how it can be justified, since they did have a treaty that guaranteed them enrollment. So people are worried, though, because supposedly, you know, you have this the sovereign tribe, right, that can't be, that's separate from the federal government, but that's just, it's not so. And it's going to set up this precedent that's really threatening to all these other tribes. And that's often what happens, like, in Indian country, like when the Klamath tribe was terminated. It wasn't the only one. I think it was one of three tribes that was terminated, but a lot of other tribes lawyered up, and so that stopped, you know, because they got, they protected themselves against it happening to them. So a lot of tribes are keeping an eye on what's happening with the Cherokee. So, you know, I don't know, when you're dealing with the federal government, I mean, sovereignty is it's often a big straw something.
Yeah, it's hard to distinguish, because there's all these terms that come in between, that come in to name the different layers of political sovereignty. So on Guam, there's like a zillion to kind of cover over the colonial status, to kind of cover over the colonial wound that is Guam, both for those on Guam who are desperately taught, like in Medell's, like taught to be American, taught to desire the United States, taught to be one with the United States, but then can't ever be, because you're constantly slapped in the face in the ways that, like, the United States doesn't think you're American, or the United States does not treat you as American. Federal laws, the Supreme Court, the Congress, the President, Department of Interior, none of them treat you as American, even if they say you are. And so, on Guam, and then from the United States, it's the same thing, that there's this wound, there's this exception, there's this thing which kind of says, that kind of shows like a break in the promise of the greatness of the United States, that, oh, there's these Americans that don't get to participate in our American democracy. And so you have calls by some leftists after the invasion of Iraq saying, well, if we're going to spread democracy to the world, we should probably start with the Americans who don't have it, who don't have it already. And so, speaking to those terms that cover over this colonial wound, you have like territory, possession, protectorate, dependency, you have Guam, you have tourist labels, Guam where America's day begins, Guam America and Asia, Guam USA. Like, and so autonomy in a way is kind of, it often serves as another filler to fill that gap. So it's like, oh, so maybe you don't have sovereignty, but at least you have autonomy. I mean, you get to make casinos, or on Guam we have a local government. You get that, so therefore in a sense you're autonomous. Like on a day-to-day level, the United States doesn't really control your life, because you have that government, and that's where your autonomy stems from. But on the other hand, like that government, my government exists through the passage of a congressional act. It can be abolished with a vote in Congress immediately, like that. All they have to do is write the bill that says, we choose to abolish the government of Guam, and it'll disappear like that. And then it's always like this. The Supreme Court, just like with Native Americans, has ultimate control over rules on Guam. And so if you think that power up here does not affect life down here, that's wrong. Just like George Bush should be kind of held accountable for some of the actions of Rumsfeld, for different commanders on the ground in the military, it's the same way that power of the federal government in dictating Guam's existence affects down here and has responsibility for it.
So yeah, so like I think also part of what my project is doing is to expose those differences between autonomy and sovereignty, because clearly we're independent, so of course, you know, the rhetoric is that we have our sovereignty. But what I argue is that we do have our autonomy in terms of, like Miguel said, our day-to-day business. Our government handles that. But clearly in our compact, it states that we can't do anything that goes against U.S. foreign policy, right? So it always comes down to the U.S. federal government dictating the limits of our autonomy, right? So I feel like they're very separate, especially in the case of Palau. And I feel like Palau, if I do the project well, I can show it. I mean, I can demonstrate that. I think it's a little bit more difficult in the case of Chamorros and Guam to show that because of all those layers that are present. I wish we could show you something that was on YouTube on how Bush described what sovereignty was, because he can't even articulate, you know, what it is. Basically, what he said was, sovereignty is sovereignty. If you're a sovereign nation, you've got sovereignty. Well, he still didn't...
He said that the Native American communities are sovereign because they've been given sovereignty.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because they were granted their sovereignty, right? So, I think that the rhetoric...
He's like a genius.
Smart. I love it that he's so bright. That word, I mean, it's a very problematic word, but very powerful in it also. So,
yeah. You guys have some questions? You want to add something to this? They know about the compact, you know.
Okay.
A little bit like Guam, a little bit.
It is week 10.
When you mentioned your degree at this university, are you thinking of staying here or going back to your inner blow, or what are you planning on doing?
I know.
I'm gonna go home, I think, yeah. I've always said I would. It's taken me a while, but yeah, my heart is there. And that's where I feel like the movement is gonna take place. And I'm in a very privileged position compared to most Palauans. I mean, I don't know any other Palauan getting a PhD right now. I only know of two other ones who've gotten their PhD. And so I feel like I can be part of the movement, but it's not gonna happen with me. So I need to go back there and work with the folks who are really, you know, doing all the work.
Here, one for you. As far as the, you said it was all American history taught in the schools. Mm-hmm. Is there any push right now currently to change that? Are you thinking about that yourself?
Since 1994, when we gained our independence, there's been a huge movement. Well, I don't want to say movement, but well, yeah, it is a movement to sort of reincorporate our cultural history, right? So, yeah, in 1997, our first history book was published. Then they created a policy where all schools were required to teach 1 year of history, even in the private schools. And then I hear that they're trying to pass a law where our Palauan language is being required for students also. But I never got that opportunity, and so I'm happy. But I was just in Palau in September, after not being there for 5 years, and I'm walking down the road and everybody speaks English. Everybody, students. She's like, oh, did you see what was on American Idol? I live in the U.S., I don't watch American Idol, but you go over there, everybody knows what's going on. right, survivor. So it's very, I mean, I hope that we can undo what we've done.
Survivor Cloud.
Yeah, Survivor Cloud, so we're on the map. But yeah, so there are things happening. And then we do have this very unique thing where we have an elderly center where the elders are brought to different schools and they teach different arts and crafts and things like that. So there's this revival taking place on the island.
This is for all of you. Do you see any advantage to working with the United Nations or any international body to gain group rights or to, like, supersede the relationship with the United States?
Well, her issue is done. The United Nations is done with her.
Yeah.
And then I know that Native Americans have made attempts to use the United Nations, and nothing ever comes from it.
Mm-hmm.
Because ultimately, I know that they've been trying for decades to draft a declaration on the rights of indigenous people,
mm-hmm.
and it goes through different incarnations, primarily because the groups that don't feel they have indigenous people, or the nations that don't feel they have indigenous people, or don't have to worry about nations within nations,
mm-hmm.
they're all for it. But the people who do, like let's say the United States or Australia, like they will not allow any language which gives native peoples the right to self-determination,
mm-hmm.
or any rights which conflict with the rights of the state over those people. So that's why Native Americans haven't had much luck. And then for Chamorros, we're on the list of the, I believe, 12 remaining colonies left in the world. Guam is on the list, along with several other, you know, small islands. From the United States, there's Guam, American Samoa, and the Virgin Islands that are the U.S. colonies left. But then, what's it called? I helped organize the delegation that went to the UN last year, because ever since the 80s, we've been sending delegations every year, because the United States has basically never allowed and never wanted this open. They decolonized Palau, the Marshall Islands, you know, the Federated States of Micronesia, the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas. Guam is theirs. No one has the right to touch Guam at all. And so, although the UN is working right now to eradicate colonialism from the world, it's in its second decade of trying to do so, it doesn't look like it's actually going to happen, except that the United States is petitioning to simply remove its colonies from the list without any process of decolonization. So, when the delegation from Guam spoke last year, I believe, the United States didn't respond officially, but then informally is trying to get the Secretary General to just take their names off the list, because our colonies are domestic issues, not international issues. And so the UN has no right to say anything about that.
I don't think that's necessarily how change happens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, so,
And then they're out of luck, because Palazzo, we have a seat at the UN, so, and we vote wherever the U.S. votes.
Yeah,
so we're
going to
always vote against.
They voted against.
You know.
Oh, that's so wrong.
So there's the whole sovereignty, right? We got our sovereignty, and so now we're in cahoots with the U.S.
So you should tell them who your ambassador is.
Oh, gosh, you guys really have to
YouTube
invest
on that
in YouTube.
Too.
I love YouTube. No, he came out in the Colbert Report.
Yeah.
So anyway,
what's his search for on YouTube?
Just punch in Palau.
Really?
Or Guam, or...
No,
yeah.
Put in Palau and then...
Daily
Colbert.
Show, Colbert.
Colbert is awesome.
He is. So he interviewed the ambassador to the UN, a representative of Palau. And the ironic part is that he's an American man. Married to a Palauan woman, so I feel like that's the connection.
Isn't he wearing a Hawaiian shirt too?
He's wearing puka shells, which are Polynesian. And then, so they make fun because they ask, you know, him if there's a navy in Palau. He said yes, and they're like, well, how many ships do you have? And he's like, one, because it's the one boat that sort of what do they call
patrols
it? Patrols.
For the illegal fishing.
That's our Navy. So they're sort of poking fun, but I think it's really ironic that this American man is the ambassador to the UN.
Should I have his quote? Do you have his quote?
Oh, no. Well, he was quoted in the New York Times. They did an interview on him when he got the position. And he said something like, look, because they asked, the question the interviewer asked was something like, how did you convince Malins that, you know, this is the best move to make, you know, towards independence? And he said, well, I told them, you don't have anything. You don't have anything anybody wants. You don't have a labor force. You don't have resources.
You don't make anything.
So this is the best. All you can offer is your UN vote. You know. So that, I mean, I think that pretty much sums up what.
I can't spell Palau.
That's just wrong.
I know.
I can't spell Palau.
Sad. I thought I could.
More questions?
You talked a little bit about your education towards like any Americanization that occurred in Palau, but were you raised in Guam, or what was that like? What was your education upbringing in terms of how they talked about America?
Well, so in my grandparents' generation, it was exactly like that. So that there was when you went to school, there was enforced hygiene, so that they cleaned you up, they, you know, basically gave you medicine, and a lot of it against your will. You didn't have any choice if they thought you had, anyways, it's really disgusting, but, you know, checking for lice every day, you know, making you swallow this disgusting medicine because they think you're all diseased. My grandparents went through that. But then after World War II, when kind of Guam became in charge of its own public school system, it became less draconian, less oppressive, but ultimately completely devoid still of any Chamorro history, Guam history. And throughout the entire period until the 70s, like, Chamorro language was outlawed. You weren't allowed to speak it in school, and you would actually be fined or punished if you spoke it. And that, then the screwed up thing is that continued even when Guam and became in charge of its own educational system. So, of course, that changed in the 70s when there were small changes to allow Chamorro language. And now, finally, although it is kind of... in the 70s, they changed it. So prior to the 70s, the official language of Guam was English. But then in the 70s, they changed it to Chamorro and English. But then Chamorro is still not taught as the language of instruction in any public schools. Mm-hmm. It's still taught as a foreign language. So it's kind of, even though it's mandated to be taught, it's treated like French or German in Guam. And it receives, even though everybody has to take it, it receives very few resources because it's a foreign language. So, yeah, when I went to school, I went to a religious school too on Guam, and they're not mandated to teach anything like that, any Guam history or Chamorro language and stuff. So, but even though there's these small changes now, ultimately education in Guam still is about Americanization. So, just like the media, you know, in Palau, is that Guam and these places in the Pacific, these dependencies of the U.S., we're all kind of, that's the way we exist. We watch things from the United States, and we're constantly, like, feeling that I don't have that here. I need to go to the United States where I can be complete, where I can be a part of American Idol, because American Idol doesn't do whatever those auditions on Palau or on Guam. Like, I need to go where I can do those things. Like, my grandfather, he would always complain when he would talk about growing up under that education system. He would always say that I would have done anything to have seen a squirrel, because I was constantly hearing about squirrels in school. I was constantly hearing about snow. I was constantly hearing about these tall, huge mountains. And I was taught, you know, and he was taught through these things, because education in Guam for 100 years is basically stuff taken from California, from Colorado, or from New Mexico, and just taught to people on Guam, because since it's American, it's good enough for anybody. It doesn't matter.
And then there were long periods where we had Peace Corps teachers who came, you know, from the U.S., and so that's primarily where the education came from. What Miguel was describing in terms of his grandfather's experience is really interesting because I still experienced it when I was going to grade school. They would have us line up every morning in front of the American flag, and we'd do the Pledge of Allegiance, sing the national anthem, and then they'd go through all of us and we'd have to show our nails, they'd check underneath our skirts, our uniforms, check our hair. So, and I'm not that old. So, I mean, this is not too long ago. And I'm very familiar with the taste of soap because we were not allowed to speak our languages in school. And it's still the same way today. English is the language of instruction. Even though we have clown teachers today, they still encourage us to speak in English while we're on school campus and things like that. So, like Miguel said, it hasn't changed. The primary sort of focus of our educational experience is the American knowledge and history.
So what kind of things can people do to learn more or be involved?
About our...
Yeah.
Get a PhD.
There's a lot of
joke.
Stuff to read nowadays. I mean, online, even Palauans and Palau have blog spots now where they're talking about these issues. Miguel writes enough. He could just go to his site and just read. He writes enough on it. So, but there's plenty of,
For Guam and for the rest of the world, if you can decrease the power and the violence of the U.S. military, you will save a lot of places. Because right now, a few days ago, there was this huge conference, international conference in Ecuador, for the abolition of U.S. overseas, for the abolition of U.S. and overseas bases. And so in that, a group of Chamorros went there from that, and it was really surprising because it was finally like, Medea Benjamin wrote a piece about it, and she actually mentioned Guam. And see, the thing for me is always that when people organize against wars, when people critique U.S. military, they always do it from the most visible, the most spectacular, the most violent points. So it's that there is a war taking place and it must be stopped. So you fix it, you call into the violence in Iraq and stuff, that's cool, that's very important. But then there's all these different levels and these foundations which build that violence up. And the majority of it is completely invisible. And because Guam is completely invisible to most of the world, the United States' power in Asia and the Pacific depends upon Guam being completely invisible, so that when it moves troops there, no one says anything, no one even cares. Everyone respects its right to move troops there, to move nuclear submarines there, to move aircraft carriers there, to move spy drones there, to move a fighter wing there. And this is happening every day, all the time. And so for me, if you want to do something, and if you are part of organizations which are for peace or which are against war, then what you need to do is bring into your philosophy for organizing what to do with these minute, small, tiny places, which basically the power of the United States military is dependent upon, such as Guam, Diego Garcia Island, Guantanamo Bay, and these small, tiny bases which the U.S. is developing throughout Central Asia, which they don't call bases. So they say, we don't have any bases in Asia, because they're like forward operating points. They use another term for them, so they can say we don't have any bases there. So, and then also, the bases are really important, because Iraq, they're building bases, they built bases, and some of them are the most important in the world to the United States right now. So if you want to help Guam's status, or even Palau's status, because Palau is not allowed sovereignty because it is strategically important.
So they say.
And, well, no, it is. They're going to use you to train Marines in guerrilla warfare soon.
I mean, there was another media thing where somebody had said, oh, Palau has nothing to offer this war. And yet we have soldiers out there fighting, you know. My brothers, I have cousins out there, but they don't count us because we're not U.S. citizens, right? So what is our function? So I would go further and say that, you know, to be critical of the goings on, you know, like here and there and everywhere, because you know, I'm not here by mistake. Like somebody had told me in my undergrad years, well, why don't you go back where you came from if you, you know, you're being too critical towards the U.S. Well, I'm here because the U.S. is there, right? And a lot of people are here because the U.S. was wherever they came from. But a lot of times we blame or we just place the focus on our arrival here as very voluntary, very, we came here because we desire the U.S. Well, there's a very clear connection to why certain people are allowed to be here and why they aren't. And so I ask that you be critical of that. And that's what I teach primarily in our ethnic studies courses around immigration and racialization. Why are certain people allowed to be here? Why can Palauans serve in the military and still remain Palauan citizens, right? What's going on there? And then how come we get naturalized quicker than other people simply because we're serving the armed forces? So, you know, there's all those little sites where you can actually take a look and see or figure, try to understand what's really going on. So I would just, that's another thing.
I've got a comment on what you said about non-citizens serving in the military. Mm-hmm. It's actually, you don't really hear about that too much, but what, and it is all over in the enlisted side of the military. And there's actually a good amount of jobs that non-citizens cannot do in the military. I'm not exactly sure, but I think it's nuclear submarines. I know for sure you can't work special operations.
Yeah, you have to have security clearance.
I know for sure you can't
clearance.
Work in civil,
right.
Yeah.
Anything with security clearance,
you're
you
not
can't.
Allowed to do.
So, you know, so where are they working then, right? They're on the front lines. They're doing all the hard sort of menial laboring jobs, right? Or they're out on the front lines. So now I've also heard that I have another colleague in our department who deals with Mexicans who are recruited. It's like they recruit private armies into the U.S. military, and they tell them, well, if you, and then once they pass, if they die during war, they get U.S. citizenship after the fact. But only them. It's not extended to their families, right? So, I mean, there's things like that where you just have to wonder, like, what's going on, right?
I think the idea of, like you said, you know, if you want to help, like, the bigger picture, you have to, like, go after displacing war is, like, our way of interacting with everyone else. But that's not, like, something you can do over the weekend, you know? Like, you have to, like, think of ways, and you know, it's hard, but I think being active in your community is incredibly important and something I try to make a priority. And I was just recently at a conference and we were talking about nutrition in prisons, basically, and it took this conversation towards when people are going, and like you said, you know, middle class and upper class people aren't who make up the military, aren't who make up the people who are doing the fighting. And then they make up, you know, like people who are Catholic officers and stuff who are trained to do that. But people who make up the fighting forces are not middle and upper class people. And one thing that we have like a lot of things going in between, but we're gonna work on it here. So I think one thing that they talked about, if you want to display that, is who makes this group of people that makes up the base of who is doing all the fighting. One way they try to go about it was going around into neighborhoods and be like, don't tell your son to go in the military. And the parents are like, okay, well, you tell me a program that offers them something other than the violence that's in this neighborhood, you know? And they're like, the military, it seems like, you know, really ultimately more destructive to these communities than is beneficial. But at the time, it seems like a way to get them away from this community that at the time seems most instrumental, away from that violence, away from these cycles of poverty, all that type of stuff. So I think when Mr. Alvarez said, you know, what can we do now, today, I think maybe looking into things like being mentors in community organizations might be a very small step towards it. But if you want to get to that bigger picture, that's where it's got to start, you know? So I think that that may be something if you're really interested to look into doing, but and it is a very small step, like I said, but a very necessary one.
Small steps create movement.
Absolutely.
Right. So, yeah.
I just have a comment about what you were saying about primarily people doing the fighting or whatever, are typically not middle class or upper class. I was, probably mentioned this class, but I was deployed in Afghanistan and Iraq. And we had, our platoon was roughly, give or take, like
one or two ethnic towns, there's usually 42, 43 people. We have three minorities out of that. The rest are Caucasian.
But there's Caucasians in the lower classes.
Yeah, that's
okay. I know. But I mean, primarily, actually, yeah. It was mostly like YMCA middle class type white Caucasians that are that were in there. So it's you know that might be different. I don't know the actual statistics of it, but
the
my situation.
Was that the Navy?
I was a Navy SEAL, so it was a little different.
Well, you should also think about that. Like, Navy SEALs also very prestigious things to be in the military.
Yeah.
Something you have to work at. You know, that means another.
I did it at a different angle, but definitely.
Which is ironic. That's what my brother was working towards, and he naturalized. And he called me one day, and he said, "Sis, I have to change my citizenship."
Yep, that's one of the.
And I said, "Do you really have to do this?" Mm-hmm. I mean, because it's a very hard decision to make, right? I mean, my brother is very Palawan. He loves being Palawan. This was a huge step for him. Then he naturalized, and then he got injured, and he can't go in. So he's like a lifer Navy dude pushing paperwork now, right? So.
Is there a way you can recoup your citizenship?
Well, for our country, you can have dual citizenship, but the U.S. requires you to claim only one. Right? So, I mean, he's always going to be a citizen there, but the fact that, you know, he voluntarily, mm-hmm. you know, quote unquote, made that choice. It was very violent for him. It's traumatic. And so, and my father was not happy. But, so these are the sort of experiences that, you know, folks have to go through.
We were mentioning mentoring kids was like a way to have them, like, not necessarily to have alternate routes out mm-hmm. of poverty. There's a group in the UO who came and talked to my classes called Project Yana.
Yeah.
And that's what they do. They promote alternatives to military enlistment.
And that project actually came out of, Project Yano came
yeah.
out of
YAO.
A group who, I mean, because they're targeting Mexican-American communities who have this large number of enlistees, and so they were sort of going into schools where that was, like, ROTC and whatnot.
And I think it's definitely, like, these local types, smaller things where ideas of multiple identities, you know, and developing an identity based on whatever means you choose, and so really that can be facilitated. In places like the military, where that's like the first priority to, you know, obliterate totally or to erase. I think if these movements are going to take people identifying in certain ways and then to build coalition, I think that again, like smaller local things that build up from, you know, the bottom up are going to be the way.
And I mean, it's important to remember that even in our communities, we have people like my brother who say, no, we got to work from the inside. So he feels very comfortable about being in the Navy
mm-hmm.
and also being very Palawan,
mm-hmm.
right? And he's like, this is my sort of investment in this movement,
mm-hmm.
right? And keeping it real and keeping it Palawan and whatnot and working for other Palawans who come in. So we're not, I mean, there's all kinds of movements taking place
mm-hmm.
with different angles and focuses
mm-hmm.
and even goals, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But they're movements nonetheless.
Okay. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.